Hi, everybody, and welcome to part two of the Best of Telich Talks 2023. Virgil Dominic is a legend in the Cleveland television market. In fact, he has had a big imprint all over television throughout this country. He was my old boss at Channel 8, hired me at the age of 27 in 1980. He built the station from third place in the ratings all the way up to first, where it has held that high ranking for many, many years. So how did we hit that spot of number one? Here is another one of Cleveland television legends that figures into the entire scenario. Here's Virgil Dominic.
And so one day, one of the people challenged me. It was after the 6 o'clock show, and I always had a meeting after the six to review the show and to coach a little bit more. You know, this is what we did right. This could have been a little better. Never saying you made a mistake. And so this guy got up and he challenged me. He said, we don't like you. We don't like your style. You don't know what the hell you're doing, you know. And he went on and on in front of my old staff. And so I had learned from a Christian group, it's okay to lose your temper as long as you know you're in control of your temper. So I couldn't let that pass because it was a threat to my authority as the news director. So I lit into it. I said, listen, buddy, I don't work for you. You work for me. And if you don't like it, you can leave. I've very seldom had to do anything. And we went, and he argued back. Finally, I made some closing remark, and there was a wastebasket in front of me, and I went up and I kicked that wastebasket from the front of the office back to the back of the newsroom. And you know what? Shortly after that guy left, I never had a problem again. So management is really, really, really interesting.
How many people did you bring from Atlanta? Were there some reporters or some?
I brought two people back from Atlanta. One of them you know very well, and that was Grant Zalba.
Yes.
Oh God, Grant was a wonderful guy, and at that time he was our chief photographer.
Yeah, he had a history as a photographer.
He was a great photographer. Yeah, he shot all the NFL games on Sundays for the NFL Network, and a lovely man. So I brought him back, and I made him assistant news director. And then I brought back another guy you probably recall named Tom Reed. And
yep,
Tom Reed was just a little guy, but a terrific producer. And so then we began to build again, you know. And gradually, you know, the ratings got better. And 3 years... It's so interesting, you know, let me divert just a little bit. So, you know, the shows were getting better. You could tell they were pretty darn good newscasts. So my general manager calls me up one day, and Bill Flynn. And Bill says, you know, you're doing pretty good. He says, when are we going to be number one? And I said, well, Bill, you know, I don't know. And he said, what do you mean you don't know? He says, you're the news director. You're in charge. When are we going to be number one? And I said, no, you know, it doesn't work like that. And he says, well, how does it work like that? And I said, well, here's what we can do. I can guarantee you that we're going to hire the best people. We're going to train the best people. And they're going to do the best work in town. And we're going to have a wonderful newscast. But then something else has to happen. He says, what is it? So I said, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. But some other event that we can't control has to happen. So he looked at me and he said, well, okay. So I go back down, and I don't know how many more months later, you know what happened? The great Dorothy Fuldheim at Channel 5, she passed away. And honest to God, when she left the earth, it was as if that event had given permission to all the faithful Channel 5 viewers to look around for another station. We had our act together. They found us. And from that, almost that day forward, every newscast we did, morning, noon, night, was number one. 15 years in a row, every newscast we did was number one.
John Vaso wrote a book called Today's Heroes, Surviving with Style. He did it with numerous cancer survivors. However, Vaso also was a pro bowler back in the day, and early in 2023, Mr. Vaso, who had suffered a stroke a few years previously, recovered enough to record a monumental night at the lanes. Here's John Vaso.
I bowled out on tour. My best finish was sixth in a national tournament. I got to sit on national TV.
Okay.
I did throw 200-300 games, and I have never given up my pro card. So I'm a 66-year-old professional bowler.
This is awesome.
Yes, and I pay my dues every year. You know, it's I just want to die with my pro card. I haven't really competed since the early 90s, and I quit bowling in the 90s because my children were little. Yeah. I bowled at Wycliffe Lanes, and my son would say, or daughter, would you read me a story? And I'd go, no, I have to go bowling. Monday night at 9:30, I'd leave the house about 8:45, and I'd get there, and the lanes were broken down. And we didn't start till 10:15, and I thought, I didn't read John or Angela's story because I had to go bowling. So I quit bowling for 10 years. A gentleman, a law firm down in Cleveland, Jim.
Names are tough to come.
Jim up. Griffith. Jim Griffith.
Oh, Jim Griffith. Okay.
Yeah, McDonald Hopkins. He asked me if I would bowl at the Cleveland Athletic Club. I flat out turned him down in 96. 97, in 01, I went and walked through the place. I fell in love with it. The athletic club closed the end of 07. My wife and my daughter and I were there when they closed. Our league went to Cloverleaf. Now it's at Yorktown. We still compete against the Detroit Athletic Club since 1915.
There's we have been a competition.
An inner club, and we've been going up to Detroit the last few years because we don't have a club. But I've met great friends, you know, through that journey with Cleveland Athletic Club. I'll share this with you. I've had 7 300 games before April 5th of this year. I had a stroke 3 years ago on April 5th of 2020. I go bowling on April 5th. Of 2023, there's a gentleman that bowls at Yorktown in the league next to us. Joe's 63-64, had a stroke in 2021. And I got to be friends with him because one of the bartenders there introduced me. I walked up to him. I go, hey, Joe, how you doing? He goes, good, John. How about you? I go, good. I go, just want to let you know, today is 3 years since I had my stroke. And he goes, wow. He goes, well, you're doing okay. I go, yeah, I'm getting by okay. I shot 192 that night, 179. In the third game, I threw 12 shots, as good as I've ever thrown 12 shots in my life. And I had done it 7 other times. I got up in the ninth frame, said, if I throw this strike, I know I'm going to strike in the 10th, 11th, and 12th. And I did throw the strike in the ninth. I got up each time in the 10th frame, the 11th frame, and the 12th. And I have a bowling coach named Phil Cilia, and his son, Phil Cilia Jr., owns Custom Fit Pro Shop. I got up and I said, Phil, I'm just going to let gravity do its job. I threw the 10th one. I threw the 11th one. I got up for the 12th shot. I said, Phil, gravity, mom and dad, I love you. And I threw an absolutely spectacular shot that people captured on video, posted on Facebook. It's as close to a near death or a spiritual, you know,
all rolled into
moment.
One.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there were two guys that came up to me that were in tears that I bowled with. And when I told them that it was a 3-year anniversary, because nobody in the league knew that it was 3 years. I knew and I told Joe. So after a couple of them knew, they were just awestruck. I averaged 193 this year. You know, the last couple of years, my average has been under 200, but I averaged 200 from 19 years of age, you know, through 63.
And so, you look great.
You know, I feel good. I feel good. Yeah. And I'm grateful. I want to tell you, it was difficult learning how to walk again.
Gab Cruz is a media personality. They call her the Sports Gab. You've probably seen her in the ballpark in Cleveland as an in-game host at Cleveland Guardians baseball games. A former college track athlete, she started Love Doesn't Shove, a nonprofit to encourage nonviolent solutions for relationships. She suffered through an intense, toxic, abusive relationship with a former high school boyfriend. It led to Love Doesn't Shove.
Up in his fashion, he ended up coming back to school and getting irate in front of my friends. And that's when they really knew, all right, we're going to separate you guys. And I have great friends. To be fair, as soon as they knew, they didn't need any other information.
What could they do before they actually knew about it?
Yeah, I mean, 3 years I've dated this guy, never said a word, and I told them in 20 seconds, and they were like, sure, well, we're going to separate you guys. This isn't, the night's over. And, you know, they told my boyfriend, you're going to stay upstairs with so-and-so. Gab, you can stay in, you know, my friend Taylor's room. She'll stay with her boyfriend, Evan. So we all separated. And it escalated because later that night at, you know, in the middle of the night, there was a knock at the door of the dorm that I was sleeping in.
Okay.
I kind of thought it was my friend Taylor because I was sleeping in her bed. We had all gotten rearranged. Or maybe it was an RA, I don't know. So I opened the door, and it was him.
Oh, no.
So it just got worse from there because it was like no time elapsed. It was like no time elapsed. He was super aggressive and continued yelling at me and trying to choke me on and off, pulled me out of the room, ripping the jewelry off of me. Luckily, someone could overhear this, though, because this is in a dorm. So luckily someone ended up calling the campus police and they showed up. But then I couldn't ignore that. Then they're making us do the police reports. Then they're calling someone in from the Violence Prevention Center. Then they're telling me I might have to tell my parents about this. And they're saying he can't come back here. He's going to have to get a restraining order. He has to be banned. It all came to this crescendo and I was going to have to tell my parents. So then I had to tell my family about this, and now that my friends knew, there was no going back on that. So everyone kind of very lovingly but sternly said, your safety is what matters the most, and we're not going to support it if you stay with him. And they kind of just laid it out. And so, yeah, like the act kind of had to give up. And I wasn't happy about it. I know that sounds crazy because he was frightening.
Sure.
But I was just, like I said, I was still in love with him, and I'm like, oh man, I was really gonna need some help to get out of that scenario. So the school ended up helping me, pointing me to the support group through the Domestic Violence and Child Advocacy Center. I went to that support group. It took me a year to do that. I didn't really do anything right away. I was like very confused. But because of the resources that support group gave me, it was so healing, and I learned so much. Like, why would I?
How long of a period were you through them, working with them?
I went to them my whole senior year.
So the relationship kind of ended at the end of your third year?
End of my sophomore year. Junior year, it was a weird year for me. I didn't really get any help. My friends were kind of telling me, you know, you're not yourself. Like, I tried to quit the track team and stuff.
Okay.
And I was having, like, outbursts. Like, I wasn't
being myself.
You were
just out of sorts. You just were,
Yeah, my friends were like, you're not yourself. They're the greatest. My friends are the best people. They're my family now. But, you know, they told me straight up, you're not being yourself. You're being really defensive all the time. You're trying to quit the team. What's going on? Like, maybe you need some help. So it was a little delayed, but my senior year is when I ended up taking the school up on the offer, and I went to the support group. And it was extremely healing because it was educational, and it was the first time I was in an environment around people with very similar stories being coached, you know, saying, like, it wasn't your fault. It's not your fault. That was the first time that really registered. It wasn't your fault that he behaved that way. That's his problem. You didn't cause that. So these little...
But you never heard this before because nobody knew.
Yeah, I was only hearing what he was telling me. Yeah. You know, if you wouldn't have done this, then I wouldn't have, you know, thrown your research paper out the window. Or if you wouldn't have gotten me so upset, I wouldn't have chucked your phone on the ground.
So, Gab, how did you go from being, you know, embroiled in this toxic relationship, you extract yourself from it, you get help, but all the while you're thinking about, I got to do something to help other people. I mean, it's kind of... a conundrum to me, but yet you did navigate that. You went from, you're in the middle of this thing, and now there's maybe a light at the end of the tunnel for you to get away from this, but now you're thinking about, let's start an organization that can help people.
Yeah, I guess that was the long way to say I created Love Doesn't Shove after I had gotten the help that I really needed, because I was like, that help was so healing and educational. I was like, we should really be talking about this. Not, you shouldn't have to go through that experience before you find out a lot of this information.
Yeah.
So I felt particularly, you know, I was through the support group, and I ended up switching my minor to sociology too. And I learned like about family violence, gender studies, human behavior. All that was so informative. And I'm thinking like, wow, I want to gift a lot of this education that I've learned through the support group. And even in sociology, I was like, we should, some of this should be things that we're telling students early, you know, just mm-hmm. in case. And that was kind of the birth of Love Doesn't Shove. I told my roommate I wanted to do something just to raise money and donate it back to the Domestic Violence and Child Advocacy Center, because I really believed in what they were doing. They helped.
Ron Ross, age 65, completed the iconic and incredibly intense Badwater 135. It's one of the most grueling, hot, very difficult ultra marathons on the face of planet Earth. But that's just a tiny snapshot of his extraordinary running career. Think of 100-mile ultra marathons. Now think times 100. Here's Ron Ross.
I was thinking of going back this year in 2023, okay. Even though it's over.
Yeah.
Because it was been 40 years since yeah. I've been back. But I didn't want to, because Mohican and was in June, and then Badwater was in early July.
Mm-hmm.
And Western States is always at the end of June. I didn't think my 65-year-old body could hold up. So I didn't even apply.
You were thinking about the recovery time, and yet we've seen some amazing instances of individuals that have done everything from Western States to Badwater to Hard Rock, all of
yes.
these iconic races, and they just keep blowing through them. And what we saw this year with Courtney DeWalder, what
yes.
she did, it's just absolutely spectacular.
Yes.
But back to you. You are on this mission to run 100 100-mile ultra marathons.
I'm hoping if I could stay healthy, I think I got a shot in the next 2-3 years.
Where are we at right now?
Well, right now, close to 87.
I think wow.
I got to do an official count, but I think I'm at 87. So I got to go back to all my records. Because the guy that is the proprietor of the 100-100 Club,
okay,
you gotta have proof. And so, like, the Western States is good. They have, before it was handwritten, and they put it in a digital format.
Yeah.
Some of the races weren't digital back in the 80s.
Okay.
And so I'm having trouble finding results for two of the races.
Okay, so you have to literally yourself, you've got to authenticate every
yes.
one of these. How many people yes. are in the 100-100? I mean, there can't be.
I think there's, you can't hold me to this. It's under 30.
I would have even thought even less than that. That it just yeah. seems like such an amazing accomplishment, Ron.
Yeah, I think there's 26 or 27 folks in the 100-100 Club.
Yeah. Well, for people to understand 100-mile races, let's just let them understand one.
Okay.
Your mindset as you prepare for one, and then race day starts and the competition begins. Take us through that. Just some of the demons that you deal with, the pain caves that you visit, all that stuff.
True. Yes, there are demons. But the demons you're talking about, that's the mental side of it.
Yeah.
The pain cave is the physical side. But as I prepare, you know, I'm on the trails, you know, around
yeah.
here and on the
Buckeye Trail.
Getting the mileage in. But the longer you go, the more mental it is. And so when the demons, and during the race, everything changes after 100K, which is 62 miles. Mm-hmm. Then the doubts just skyrocket. And you really got to fight that. Those are the demons that are telling you to stop and let's rest and whatever. But I just want to say that the strength, the mental strength, when those guys at Ranger School couldn't break me, I always go back to that. I always go, hey, they couldn't do it, and I'm not going to do it. I didn't come this far to come this far.
Yeah.
And I'm going to keep going. Same thinking. It's just kind of funny how, I don't know, that's my my base.
Mm-hmm.
Those days back in the military, I just go back to that and go, hey, they couldn't do it. I'm not going to do it now. It's funny how I'm always remembering that.
Take our listeners through how it might even be over the course of one ultramarathon, 100 miler, let's say, where it could be ankle in the first 20 miles, and then maybe it's, my God, it's your hip in for another 20, and then it could bounce over to a strained calf muscle. How you negotiate yourself through that?
Well, because there's a thought. The thought is, if you're never going to be 100% healthy.
Never.
I think when you're always going to have a ding with something. And if you wait till you're perfect, then you're going to be a grandpa sooner than you think, and you're never going to run. So anyway, so to get yourself through that, I think I just, go back to the mental game. It's like, I can do this, I guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't have the magic elixir or the magic answer.
Yeah.
But such a significant injury where I had to stop. I've had the naggers, and I've turned an ankle here and there, but you just find a way to keep going.
Jack Mulhall was grieving his wife's death. He couldn't sleep. He had bad knees, which made walking pretty difficult. But that did not stop him from hopping on a plane to France to attempt the 500-mile Camino de Santiago, a spiritual walk mostly in the north of Spain. Here's his story.
It's amazing how that art kind of is, you get to experience that like I have never in the past been a person that really appreciated art.
Okay, consumed it per se.
Yeah, yep. And that changed for me. Like, I got to experience it in a different way, and now I like going to art museums and things like that. So it just happened, but it was like it was meant to happen.
So as you're actually about to embark, head over, fly across the pond and get it going, what were some of the trepidations that you had about it, or the preparations per se, doing it alone? I'm sure a lot of people do it alone, but then you knew of some people or even encountered people that are doing it in a group. I just kind of want to get in your mindset. You were rebounding as best as you could over Debbie's passing, and plus your own body was giving you signs of knees are gone. All right, now what are you going to do? Well, let's go walk 500 miles in Spain.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea, doesn't it, John?
That's your physical therapy, Jack. Yeah.
The preparation mentally, I knew I could do this. I don't know why, but I just knew it. And it came at a time, while I was there, it was for my Debbie's fourth year of passing, was September 18th of 2018. It was the fourth anniversary of that, and I was over there in September as part of the Camino. And also, I had met a really wonderful lady. I was starting to heal And I was had a lot of things to think about. Sure. Like I knew that I really wanted to ask Nancy to marry me. And so it was a lot of things that I was just, it gave me time to think about things. And you know, my kids were like, I think they, I'm not sure if they thought I was crazy, you know, and, or if I, you know, if I could really do it, you know, maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but
maybe some people's assertion on this would be, okay, that it sounds like an amazing undertaking, but there are package deals that do this stuff, or there are more, not necessarily safer, but more conventional, if you will. You're just saying, with all these baggage on your mind, things going on, what happened to your dear wife, the future as you move forward, you had a lot of stuff to process. You just happened to do it in one of the most iconic walks, hikes, all in the world.
Yep. And yes, and I wanted to see what would happen, in a way. And I'm glad I did. Because amazing things happened.
Such as?
Just how sometimes when you're open to allowing the universe to, and I know that sounds metaphysical, so I don't mean to say it like that, but if you're open and just let things kind of happen, what can happen? And it happened on the whole trip for me.
Wow.
You know, on the plane ride from Chicago to Paris, I met a gentleman who we struck up a conversation, just talked almost the whole plane ride. And then he helped me get my train tickets at this to get, I had to get to the big train station. So I had to take some of the local trains to get there. I had no idea I can't speak French, and he helped me do everything. And then when I got to the starting town, it's called Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, I couldn't find my albergue, the place I was supposed to stay that night. Nobody could help me. I couldn't speak French. They couldn't speak English, or they did, you know. And I was walking around, just stumbling around, basically trying to find this place. And I finally ended up just knocking on a door. And this older French gentleman came to the door in his smoking jacket, could smell a little alcohol. I mean, he was just relaxing for his evening, you know, and here's this American knocking on his door. He can't understand me. I can't understand him. And I'm trying to communicate. And then I show him on my phone that I'm trying to find this address. And he motions for me to go down to his driveway. And next thing I hear is garage door coming unlocked, open. He backs his car out and he drives me to the albergue.
An update on Jack. He and his new love were married very recently. What a great story for Jack. Up next is Dean Hall, who swam the 187-mile-long Willamette River in Oregon. He was the first to do it. He swam the River Shannon up in Ireland. And those record-setting quests were just born out of his intense battle that he had with leukemia and with lymphoma. He was close to death, but he came up with a veritable Hail Mary challenge that cured his cancer. He continues to this day to counsel folks, and he, of course, looks forward to his next challenge.
I'm like, Dad, you're 79. He's like, no problem. I'm like, Dad, you've never been in a kayak. Oh, I'm like, okay. So we started going out on practice swims, which I desperately needed anyway. And he got the hang of it, and I got the hang of it. And because we knew each other so well, we got into this beautiful rhythm, and it was one of the most miraculous gifts I was given from that whole journey. The hardest challenge was the cold. because it was 42 degrees. And even with the 3 mil wetsuit, I'd go into pretty deep hypothermia, what they call thrombosis.
Okay.
Within about 40, 45 minutes, he'd make me pop up and he'd ask me a couple questions. And if I was slurring my words or having a hard time thinking, he would get me out. And then after swimming for 45 minutes straight, I'd have to jog in place or do jumping jacks or run in place in order to warm up and then get in and do that again for 8 to 10 hours a day. Yeah.
Kept going at it, man. You just, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And the way to answer your question more specifically, the way I was able to do it was not thinking of the whole 187 miles. We had it broken down into daily stages. I would only think, and this is a great way to live. It taught me a lot about life. I make my plans now, but I really don't think even 2 weeks ahead. I've made my plans. I've knocked out a schedule. And then I think about that day. And then even when I got in the water, I didn't think about the whole day. We had broken down 45 minute intervals, and I would just swim and try to keep going until he would say, hey, it's time to get out. And that always seemed like it was way longer than it should have been.
Well, what a, what
but a, that's what made it. That's what made it happen. I just did it one 45 minute segment at a time. Pretty soon my day was done. We'd go celebrate, have some fun. And then I'd eat 8 to 10,000 calories and sleep till 7 o'clock the next morning. We'd try to get in the river by 8, 9 o'clock and do it all over again.
Jessica I is a retired MMA fighter who at one stage in her career was named the UFC's Comeback Fighter of the Year. She suffered abuse at the hands of her father as a teenager, and she says that those issues actually fueled her during her fighting career. But now retired, she's mapping out her future. Here's Jessica I.
I think that, you know, my father is now passed, you know, in, you know, God rest his soul. And I think that where he is, you know, in a better place now. In that regard. So where I'm at now from 2016, when my father died, till 2023, you know, here we are now. And I forgive my father for what he emotionally was intelligent enough to do. I mean, he was doing his very best of what he thought he could do. I'm not one to hold necessarily grudges. I do like the word accountability. And I feel like my father, his accountabilities happened to him in other ways, but I have to be accountable to myself of how I'm going to handle what happened to me moving forward, right? I'm accountable for my behaviors. I'm accountable for my emotions. I'm accountable for how I make a difference in the world moving forward. And for fighting, it was only fighting was my hyper focus, like just making it through the career. And now that I'm retired a year from it, I've been able to spend more time healing, that I only hope that I can help other athletes, other individuals, you know, that have kind of ran from that, you know, or not even ran from it. You know, fighting was my catalyst. I didn't have to think about it. I didn't have to deal with it. You know, that was my everything. And now that that part of my life is over, I have to look it in the face. And now I've created, you know, Jessica Evil Eye versus Jessica I, and they're both tough and they're both super strong and they're both motivated. And, you know, I'm just teaming them up together to help moving forward and help other people in my position. But also to, you know, say it's okay to, you know, ask for some help in that regard. And you might not need it when you need it at 19. Like I didn't need that when I was 19. I didn't need that when I was 25. And even, you know, during the issues I have with my father throughout my fight career. But that's why what I need now was not what I needed then. And that's when I knew it was time to retire. I wasn't feeling the same. I didn't have the same anger. I didn't have the same drive, the same motivation in that way that fighting, you really, you know, I hate to be that one to say it, that I feel like every fighter or boxer has to have a little bit of a screw loose or something happen to make you want to want to be able to handle that. Because I'm sure I hit my knee the other day and like I was like, oh my goodness, I couldn't even imagine training on that level anymore now. Like I don't want to be hit. I don't want to take those bruises. Like I don't want to have bruised shins or beat up hands. And you know, yes, I deal with the injuries from it from previously, but thankfully, you know, I have my head, I have my wits, my joints are not completely destroyed. And I have just the ability to spend another 30 years doing something great.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing what you have in storage as your life goes forward, because it was always great to follow your story in the sense that, you know, you were one of the trailblazers. A lot of women have come after you. You're a young woman, you're getting in, you're in Bellator, then you graduate, as it were, to, you know, UFC, to the big show, as it were. Take me back, Jesse, just how much pressure you must have felt being one of those early ones in the fight game on the women's side. And, you know, how did you handle all that? Could not have been easy.
Yeah, you know, I didn't really feel pressure, to be honest. Like, I felt like it was what I was do. I felt like I was, I've said this even previously, I feel like I'm the girl who goes through things to show you can get through them. Huh. Right? You get to look at my story or see the way that I handle it, but I never felt pressure in that regard for that. It wasn't until I got to the UFC that later years, the pressure to win a world title, you know, like there was pressure from, you know, seeing Stipe, and not that anybody put it on me, but Stipe did it. And I was like, man, I want to do that. And that was what I created. No one created that for me, but it was more or less, you know, something I wanted to do.
So there you have it. And thank you very much to everybody who has sat before a microphone and opened up about their story to me. I've really appreciated the honesty that you have put forth in our conversations. And thank you to you for taking me along for the ride, for listening to me while you're taking your morning walks or out at the gym or just maybe enjoying a quiet time and listening to the story of someone out there who's trying to make a difference in their life. And of course, if you do enjoy the episodes, please hit that follow button, rate and or review. How about even consider sharing an episode with one of your friends? And as always, I look forward to the next time that we meet, our next edition of Telich Talks. Have a great day, and we'll see you then.